Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, June 4th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 162. I'm your host, Austin Walker, and joining me today in the studio here in Brooklyn, Danielle Riendo.
Greetings, space assholes.
Oh, it is. It's space asshole day, everybody.
It is. It's a special day.
It's a special day for all space assholes everywhere. Also joining me from other parts of space, but equally assholes, is Danielle and I, Rob Zachney.
I come from the land of the masshole, I'll have you know.
Oh, that's true.
That's a good
fair.
Point.
That's true. Yeah. What type of asshole are you, Patrick Klepek?
I'm the one that's wondering that if they should send Agent 47 to space and have him fuck up some aliens.
Yes. All right. They should do,
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yes.
God, imagine like the Hitman, like, you know, elusive target where like you open it up and it's the Xenomorph.
Oh my god.
Who's hunting who?
Agent 47 on the Nostromo.
Yes, 100%. I mean, so they got they did that like movie set one where it was like a fake Iron Man movie. What if they just did one where it was like a fake alien movie, but then the twist was the alien is real.
It's really here. Oh my
or it's like a robot, but it's gone like out of control, and so it's starting to hunt people down.
Five Nights at Freddy's robot.
Robot Xenomorph.
Xenomorph.
Right.
Oh my god.
How do we feel about Xenomorph? Are we good with the term Xenomorph?
Okay with it.
It's one of those things that like it's not Xenomorph is not canon,
right?
Or, like I forget exactly how it works, but like it's not. I don't think it's actually uttered in the film.
Anything.
Like,
it's not.
I forget how it works, but like I remember every time I've used it, you get some snooty. And I consider myself to be a snooty alien fan, and yet there are snootier ones that say, Xenomorph is blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
But whatever. Xenomorph is fine. I mean, Xenomorph as a film series, not fine at all. Like the alien movies are not doing well. So it depends
they're
on
a place right now. It's been rough.
Hey, the last one had its moments.
The last Prometheus,
Alien Covenant.
Alien Covenant
was not
is that what
good.
It was called? Is
it
that
was
what,
not
that
good.
What it was called?
But
Austin
it had
can't
its
even
moments.
Bothered with this anymore.
Yeah, I saw all those movies.
Yeah,
me too.
I watched Alien Covenant in theaters. It was
so
fine.
Did I, with my mom. Look, we had a great time.
He played that flute. Do you remember he played that flute?
He played the flute, and it was a special moment with his hands on the other twin's hands, and there was a
David
moment.
Wanted to fuck David.
100%.
He sure did.
100%.
If that was the third movie about androids fucking. And like just leave the Xenomorph behind? Come
yeah.
on.
They should have been in the shower together. That would have made it better.
Near Xenomorphica.
Yes. Near Xenomorphica.
Androids fucking
like one
aliens.
Android just gazes deeply at a photo of another and is like,
but it's the
I
same.
Admire its purity.
This is this. Rob, did you see Alien Covenant?
No.
You're describing Alien Covenant.
I actually are.
That's that movie.
That's like a full third of that movie.
Yeah, that's
okay.
The I want to be clear.
So it was good.
Like the A-plot to that movie is that.
Yep.
It
has its moments.
Yeah, I don't know if it's good.
No, I don't think it's good, but it has its moments.
It has its moments. That's fair. That's fair. How's everybody else doing today? What are we up to? How is the summer treating you? They're like almost summer. We're almost there.
Squirrel update.
Oh,
shit. Good.
Thank you. Beep, 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 beep.
We have to say
either I should be thoroughly disappointed that I didn't get more responses from my call for help, except for one very detailed response from a listener. So thank you out there to you. Let me find you. I want to, because you were, you actually, let me see. Where is it? Sparkles. Web Andrew Webb. Good Twitter name. Thank
good
you.
One.
You actually useful information. So, last I described my squirrel problem, the worry was that when I opened up my attic, that I was like, oh, all my insulation seems chewed to shit. But I saw no evidence of squirrels living there. So I took that to be a potential positive step. Well, in more positive news, we looked up the inspection photos from when we bought our house a couple of years ago. And I actually didn't go to the attic because it's not a real attic. Like, it's an attic, but it's mostly for ventilation purposes. It's not You don't put things up there. It's not.
You don't even do like storage. You don't do like.
No,
light.
You can't. It's not. It's not meant for that at all. Okay. It's literally
so it's not even a crawl space.
No. So as it turns out, I never went up to the attic. We like had a, an inspector that we paid to like tell us like make sure everything's cool. But I didn't like go up there myself and look because I had no reason to.
Question:
so,
was the inspector just like 32 squirrels in a giant coat?
I wish that because I actually I feel like the a progressive platform of embracing the squirrels in the court but no, so actually we looked at the photos and that's actually how our installation looked then. That's actually what the installation was supposed to look like. So we're in a good place where it looks like the squirrels have not made it into the attic. And then I precariously, against my wife's wishes, went onto the roof over the weekend to take a closer look and dangle myself over the side of my house.
Patrick,
you dangled.
It's pre-E3. We can't lose you.
We can't lose you.
I'm here. Okay. I'm here. And I took a look, and actually it just looks like that not a lot's been going. They chewed through some of the wood, but they mostly just been hanging out right inside there. So I think I'm I think I'm okay.
I need to tell you all that when you were saying you dangle precariously, Austin literally took his glasses off and rubbed his eyes like a very concerned father.
I was scared. I thought maybe it went bad. I thought maybe there was a twist and Patrick was going to be like, and also I'm in the hospital now.
Podcasting from General Hospital.
Yeah.
And then once I'd already done it, I was like, well, I'm up here, so I should probably see if there's anything else wrong. And my wife just like walked away. She's like, I'm not looking at this. Like, just tell me when you're done.
Did you like clear? You could clean the gutters. There's all sorts of stuff you could do up there when you're up there.
Yeah, like how often do you get up on your roof? Because
like
you
never.
Shouldn't, because it's dangerous.
It's dangerous.
But I figured I was here, so I should like, make just, I don't know, like maybe I'd find a body or something.
On your roof?
What?
Yeah, like, I don't know. I'm just saying, I don't go up there very often. Like, I'm not sure what's happening on my roof.
You know what? I think I remember now Trump did say during the election campaign that in Chicago, you just find bodies on roofs.
It's true.
It's just not safe.
Yeah. Doesn't matter if it's the Chicago or the suburbs thereof. There's just bodies everywhere. So no bodies to report, fortunately or unfortunately.
Great. Good. I'm glad.
Squirrel
updates. Any other squirrel updates? Any other important pending? Oh, speaking of Alien, we definitely got some people who are surprised that Rob, Danielle, and I did not bring up the androids from Alien in our conversation.
I wanted to. If we were going full Blade Runner 2049, like 3.5 hour podcast, we sure would have.
Who's your favorite alien android?
It's really hard because I really like the Winona Ryder android.
Fair.
Whose name I forgot, but she left a real impression.
That's okay.
She's really good in that movie. Because she's like a secret underground android resistance fighter.
This is in the fourth movie, Resurrection.
Yeah.
I saw that once ages ago, so I can't remember very much about it.
I just don't remember her name. I watched all the Alien movies in a row like a couple of years ago again, because I do this every so often. She's really great. I'm sorry that I
Anna Lee Call is her name.
Okay.
Call is a good last name.
It's a good one.
That's a good one.
She's a good android.
Patrick, you weren't here for this. Do you have any favorite androids?
I mean, the android in Alien is good.
Yeah.
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 I don't have
Ian Holmes. Ian Holmes, android?
Yeah.
From the original Alien.
Yeah, from the original.
I think he's my favorite.
He's very good. He's very good.
Because it's such a good, shocking, like, reveal and heel turn.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Not only is the, like, not only is he an android, but, like, he's been setting you up to get murdered for, like, as long as you've known him, basically.
Right. Yeah.
He got switched onto that crew last minute.
What's the alien from Aliens called? Because Aliens has an
Sorry, the android.
The android.
Oh, Bishop.
What's the alien from Android?
Bishop.
Is Bishop the android?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, it's Bishop.
And like by then you already have been betrayed by the alien, but by the android.
That's why they don't
and
like
alien.
Him.
Right, which I liked. I liked that about that character. That was good.
Oh, Bishop's he's so also like good he's name. So woebegone and like hangdog-ish, and it's real good.
All right, we should talk about video games, I guess, instead of just squirrels, aliens, and androids.
I mean, there's a lot of video games about those three things.
Are there lots of... I guess there's some squirrels.
Yeah.
Conker.
There's Conker's Bad Fur Day. Great game. Very underrated.
Yeah.
As a game... Mm. The humor is really, really not aged well, but, like, as a game itself, it actually has a very fun platformer structure that, again, uses a lot of adventure game design stuff.
Are there squirrels in Tokyo Jungle?
Oh, good question.
They seem too small.
Where is my sequel to Tokyo Jungle? Give it to me.
I definitely looked somewhere recently and had a note. I don't know if this is like a Twitter draft. I don't know if what it was. But somewhere I had a note that was just like Tokyo Jungle 2 question mark. And I – I don't know where. I don't know
2009.
Where.
2009. There's
also, Patrick, I'm taking away your spoken clap emojis.
Oh. Thank you. We talk about some video games. I remembered that there was one that I saw a few weeks ago that I can talk about now and that I forgot to talk about last week when I said I was going to talk about it. So I'll talk about it now really quick, which is I got to see We Happy Few, which has been out in like an early access state for a while. But
Several years.
For a couple years now. It made kind of a big splash a few years ago at E3 when it had a kind of a demo that – was very structured and very narratively like focused. It's kind of a – the pitch on it originally was that it was a survival game that took place in a sort of post-war Britain, very like mod, very 50s
– like, prisoner-ish.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But a very Bioshocky vibe at a time when lots of games were going for that. And it wasn't the whole a bait and switch on it was that the trailer
– Yes.
The trailer gave – no sense that this was a survival game in the sense that what most people would associate, this is around the time when like Rust and a lot of other games were extremely popular. But the trailer was like, yo, this is just like a weird 50s like Bioshock game. Like, hell
and it
yeah.
gave you
but
that.
then you find out it's a survival game and it's like a roguelike and you're like, oh no, I don't want to play that.
So the way that – and that was the game that was out in early access for the last couple of years basically. And they've been working on it. Now at this event they showed off some stuff that was more in the Bioshocky, more in the structured, more in the handcrafted vein. So previously you played through this kind of intro segment where you are a censor. You are like a newspaper censor who's censoring newspapers and making sure that all the news sounds good and happy. And you – You go off your joy. You get a bad batch of joy, which is a special pill that makes everything look good, and you get a bad batch or something, and so you stop seeing how good everything is supposed to look.
Joy.
And so it becomes like a dystopian nightmare, obviously, where they're like people are eating dogs and are – it's wild because it's like the same – thing, the same place. It's like, oh, that's not a birthday cake. That's like a chest cavity or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so that part's still there, and then you go from that to then previously it was this open world survival thing where you had to like make sure that you had enough food and water to drink, and you were in a kind of proc gen open world area, and that was kind of it. You got story through pickups and stuff, and there were like a handful of crafted spaces that were plopped in, but that was really kind of it. And now there's still that kind of overworld map with the different neighborhoods and like some degree of proc gen, I think, but they showed us a lot more. They said that they've spent the last few years building more in that direction of handcrafted content with Bioshock influences, with like you're this person in this world who is trying to like sneak through places, and there's a bit where you have to cross a bridge, and so someone says like, oh, I can trade you the thing you need to open this bridge if you go recover my old war medals from before, and to do that you have to sneak into this facility where there's like a gang, and it's like kind of a post-apocalyptic gang that throws you into the arena, and there's NPCs, and it's a lot more structured, but it does not have the level design that makes the Bioshock games so memorable, and that makes them, I am definitely of the opinion that like I need to find the time to revisit all three of those games, because I need to see if I think they hold up, but what I do remember from them is level design that I thought was really good.
Yeah.
Even in Infinite, a game that even at the time I wasn't head over heels for, there was some really great level design. And that just hasn't shown up in what I played of it. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think I just replayed one, obviously, and we talked about it on the podcast. But yeah, that's absolutely – it sort of lives and dies by that because a lot of the systems design was actually pretty light in retrospect. And, the story was – interesting at the time, but you kind of know the tricks at this point. So yeah, the level design I would say does hold up in that. So
yeah,
that sounds a little bit disappointing. But I guess I'm glad they're at least going in that somewhat more handcrafted.
Yeah, I mean, Rob,
did it feel like it supported its narrative though? Like, because when I played, and one of the things that turned me off is that the idea of it, of being the person who's like woken up in this dystopia and everyone else is like living this delusion. Okay, even that idea hasn't aged quite as well in the last few years, but nevertheless.
That was literally in Bioshock 2. That was that was a level in Bioshock 2, was seeing how Little Sisters saw the world in this happy way.
Right.
So, yeah.
But the idea was, like, kind of cool, but when I played it, everything felt so coarse-grained in some ways. Like, characters were, like, sniffing me out as not being, like, on Joy. Like, it really felt super random, or, like, too, the swings were too hard between, like, being in stealth and then being, like, railroaded into everyone in the world trying to kill you. And it just felt like the game couldn't really support the feeling it was trying to evoke.
So what I'll say is the stuff that we played was pretty much all in a space where no one was on Joy except the cops, right? And so everyone who I ran into, it was the opposite thing, which was I was wearing a nice suit and they were not. And so they knew that I was – they thought I was on Joy. And there's like a moment early on where it's like, oh, we got to tear up your clothes so that you look like one of us so that the regular folk don't try to kill you. And it, again, like you said, very binary. Like that was not a particularly
– yeah.
Like it's an interesting – it's an all right moment, but I don't know how it systematizes because the stuff that they showed us was not it didn't ever feel like a playground in that way. It feels like a little bit like it's walking the line. And again, I'm curious to see in the full release how they come down on that. But right now it seems like they know they want to have handcrafted stuff. So these handcrafted beats of being thrown into the arena or being chased by the mob of people who think your suit is too clean or whatever. But then there is still like a thirst meter that you do have to keep up. And there is still like – you know, the way that the combat works and the damage systems are like pretty punishing. And so I'm not sure if those
things
will
blend.
Seems
like they're working backwards to build a game that they realized people wanted after they started showing it. And that obviously is easier to like probably for a smaller team to you know, otherwise you're going to have to like, you know, spend years building that. It's very expensive to build that, so it was probably easier to put out a game with one version of it and then try and work. But like, I don't know. Like, I was put off from the way the game was structured and played before that I like have so little interest to go back and give another shot. Right. But if it really has changed so fundamentally, then like maybe is it? But like, I'm also like, I don't trust these games that are going for the Bioshock thing because I. Whatever you think of Ken Levine, like those games are so expensive and tough to make.
Yep.
Like this, the trailer that people have gotten excited about over the last couple of weeks, like this like Russian Bioshock game. Have you guys seen
that? What is that called?
No.
It's a great trailer. It's a great trailer.
Yeah, I need to hear about this.
I'll find it. I'll find it because I have it in the chat that's open.
Yeah, it's Russia Bioshock. It goes for like a Cold War. Takes like Cold War aesthetic and then, you know, does the thing where it's like, it's in. Huh?
Yes, Atomic Heart. Atomic Heart.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Well, like, it doesn't even just go for a Cold War aesthetic. It actually feels very just like Eastern Bloc in terms of its like Soviet aesthetic, but also in terms of some of like the cartoonishness of it, some of the – but also ultra violent in a way that like Bioshock – Bioshock could get there, but this really goes there.
Bioshock Infinite definitely had a lot of that, maybe a little bit more than Bioshock 1 and 2. But I guess what I'm saying is I also don't believe that trailer. Like, maybe it exists. It'd be nice.
Right.
I would love it if – I would love to play more Bioshock-adjacent sort of games and seeing other people kind of play in those worlds and that sort of structure. But I just don't – like, I don't – because one part of the problem is because of that We Happy Few trailer, like, to convey a Bioshock-y game is – I don't want to use the word easy, but easier in a trailer when you're setting up things.
Yeah.
As opposed to actually building out a 12 to 15 to 20 hour game or whatever that actually pulls that off. Like trailers are a much easier lift than the actual game itself. And so I look at that Russian Bioshock trailer and I'm like, oh, this was built to get headlines that go Russian Bioshock. Yeah. And I don't blame them, right? Like I don't blame them for doing that. But like if you watch that trailer and then actually watch like the gameplay-y bits that like reveal themselves, like those don't come across nearly as well
as just like
sort of the structure.
Yeah, but like the character design in this is so good.
Yeah, it's
Soviet futurism is real good.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of Stalinhog's stuff. If you guys have looked at Simon Stalinhog, look some of his. I forget what the actual name of the series is. He has like a series in like a fictional world. Not the Electric Playground, but it's not something so dissimilar from that.
It's somewhere in there.
That
it
has a similar vibe.
The artwork about like people in like an Eastern European or Scandinavian setting like with alien ships in the background?
Yeah,
something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It has like a very near future, but like it's a combination of a sort of a commercialism and tech that like keeps it grounded. The Electric State is the name
That wasn't far. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was close. The Electric State. Yeah, absolutely. Also, Tales from the Loop is the other one that Stalin Hawk's involved with. Anyway, yeah, you're exactly right, which is like it's easy to be like, yo, look at this character design. Look at the cool drones that look creepy. Look at these robots walking all next to each other. But I don't know what that game is.
Right.
So, which is
yeah, I want to believe it's just like it sets off a certain like some red alarms when I see a trailer like that because I'm like, I see – people just want Ken Levine or whoever to go make a Russian Bioshock. Like, I get it. Like, mm-hmm. I get it. But I just – those games are hard to build, and I just don't trust it. So I love to be proven wrong, but I look at that trailer and just go,
Yeah. I've been very brief diversion, very brief, because I don't – because I'm not into the process enough to go deep into it. But does anyone here follow Worthy Bums on Twitter?
Sounds like a worthy Twitter account.
What is that account?
He's a game dev.
Okay.
He
so it's not like
not worthy. Worthless. Worthless in fact.
Bubs. Okay.
He made Steam Marines a few years ago.
Okay.
Which is like a tactical like alien game kind of. And he has this long running Fallout 4 thread that has always been super fascinating. Like when I say long running, I mean, you know, 700 posts or something. It had to jump a bunch of threads because Twitter can't handle how many replies he puts. In which what he does is he plays through Fallout 4 using a mod called Start Me Up, which is like an alternate start mod. So instead of starting as the like character from Fallout 4, you can start as like a random raider or start as a scientist or start as like someone who's already in Diamond City or whatever that was called. I think it was Diamond City.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Fenway.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, exactly. Like post-apocalyptic Fenway Park. And then also has on some like survival mods and combat mods and a mod that makes like that kind of turns it into a stalker style game where the factions are all fighting with each other over territory and blah blah blah, and just rolls new characters, like literally uses a d20 to be like, all right, this time I'm going to play A, and rolls the dice and like, oh, it's a 19, so that means I'm going to be a raider with the good hearted trait. Oh, that's hard to play. And I've been watching him do this for seriously a year now, and so finally I'm falling down the Fallout 4. I haven't even launched the game. I reinstalled it last Thursday, and for the last 6 days, right before bed, I spend like 45 minutes reading people's favorite mods and trying to put together a list of mods to do this thing. And it's so interesting because I think it is like it's coming at this problem from the other end, which is you look at a trailer like Atomic Hearts, or like you look at a game like We Happy Few, and you go, this game could be better if it was XYZ. I wish it would be XYZ. Why won't someone make it XYZ? And then taking Fallout 4 and making it more like Stalker is like, I'm going to just make it the thing I want it to be. And I know what I could be doing instead is playing Stalker, but I'm not getting the tinkery vibe that I'm getting from like trying to build out this mod list. That's what I've been doing with my life instead of playing new video games. In any case,
it's a very Rob approach to video games.
I think so. I think so. The we were talking about systemic action games, or action games that use kind of have that systemic edge. Patrick, you've been playing something that is built around a kind of weird systemic hook. Vlambeer. Got it.
Yep.
We're going to call it Vampire just to do a couple
I think
bullshit,
it is Vampire.
I think so too.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, Vampire is the new game from Don't Nod, the developers of Life is Strange. More importantly, I should probably say Don't Nod from the developers of games like Remember
Hell
Me.
Yeah.
Good game.
Yeah, underrated if deeply flawed.
Yes, 100%.
Action a sci-fi game from, geez, at this point, like what, like 6 years ago? Probably
11?
Like that too long?
2012? Wow, was it that far? Wow, was it? That sounds like it
you
might
know
be
what?
Right.
It was probably 2013. It's probably 5 years old. I'm going to guess 2013.
It was this like mid-budget sci-fi game that they made in partnership with Capcom. But also, wasn't it? It was dropped by a different, like, didn't Sony or someone drop it?
I think
it
someone else dropped
it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's
something
true.
Like that. Anyway, that's all to say that in the last like couple of years, Don't Nod has become on people's radar because of Life is Strange, like a what I thought was a tremendous like a love story that involved science fiction, but was like primarily an adventure game. Like, you know, there right. were the mechanics were pretty basic. Like a lot of the game is propelled by its story, and the interactivity parts were pretty minimal. And it was more in service. The interactivity was more in service of giving you choices and also letting you kind of explore and poke the environment. Yeah. But a lot of it was sort of self-propelled by the narrative. And so I think when you see Don't Nod, I think a lot for a lot of people, even people like myself who know better, are thinking sort of along those lines. And Vampire is not that at all. It is way more along the lines of Remember Me. I don't know how their team breakdown works, but it wouldn't shock me if like Life is Strange was a different team and Remember Me was another team, and that team worked on Vampire. But all to say, the setup for this is you wake up and you're suddenly – you don't know that you're a vampire, but, like, you just wake up and all around you are these dead bodies, and you start seeing some humans in the distance, but they're represented to you in the game as just, like, pulsing, like, flesh and blood. And all you know is that you're thirsty, and you go over and you attack the first thing you can find to try and quench your thirst. You realize it's your sister, and that it seems like maybe you've been set up to kill her, but now you're also a vampire. So it takes place in this sort of, sort of London, like in sort of a quintessential sort of like vampiric period.
It was like early 1900s. Like when the vampires.
As we all know, that was when the vampires ruled
yeah,
London
when they were,
by night.
Yeah.
Right. We overlooked that time period. But, you know, like the way like popular media tends to sort of like set like sort of like vampire stories and when
Jack
we often
the
think
Ripper
of London
era.
And stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Jack the Ripper.
Later.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. It definitely from the previews I'd seen, I saw a preview of it last E3 or maybe the E3 before. It's been in production for a little while now.
Uh-huh.
It definitely had a Jack the Ripper like aesthetic, if that makes sense. Like
yeah.
the
yeah.
I was definitely drawing on some of that. And I know it takes place during like the influenza.
Oh, so that a little
outbreak.
Bit later, but yeah.
It's like
yeah.
Spanish flu, yeah.
Spanish flu.
It's,
yes.
Like the Spanish flu yes. has just ripped through London, and I believe like in one of the dialogues set up that it's like happened the summer before. So everyone is like very much on edge about like epidemics,
like blood plagues,
and like disease and blood plagues, and like having to set up quarantine zones. And so at the same time, like this vampiric thing starts happening, and you're not sure like why you're a vampire. You didn't know vampires existed. And the game, it's like very, very quickly distinguished itself, like especially in terms of like vis-a-vis Life is Strange, because like you just get into combat like very quickly.
Okay.
Like you are hacking people up with a machete. You start rolling. The game doesn't explain this system yet. I've only played about like an hour and change, and I don't know how the system works, but like you go into a part of London, and it's like it's built into different districts, and it says like status neutral,
right?
Like suggesting that there's going to like be some sort of like meta elements you play with, like when you flick on your like they call it like vampire vision or whatever they call it, allows you to like sort of like see like blood splatter and follow different like puzzly stuff. That also brings up like when you hover over NPCs
right.
In the world, like it shows like how much their blood is worth and whether they have certain ailments.
What? Oh.
And so, like, part of the game, like, the game, like, when you click start, it says, like, this game will be harder the more people that you kill. And so I think that's setting up, like, its version of a morality system in which, like, if you want to be a bloodthirsty vampire and just fuck up this world, like, things are actually going to
right.
be easier for you. But if you want to try and they are setting up a character who feels morally conflicted
like
about what they just.
You're a doctor in this game. Who's trying to solve the influenza virus, right?
That may be true.
That,
I've not
okay, well,
that
was
far.
Part of the pitch they gave me 2 years ago.
I'm not saying that's a
okay.
spoiler. I'm just saying that we haven't gotten into your backstory. Like, oh, but like it starts like you feel horrified about the fact that you have killed your sister. Like you are disgusted at like whatever you have become, and so they at least at the outset sort of set up a character who is not quite sure where they land on this stuff.
Right.
You're not just a vampire out to fuck things up, but they are setting up a world where you very much could go in that direction, and that there are like. But there are selected adventure game elements, right? So when you highlight an NPC, it also brings up sort of what you know about them. And, like, this is, like, actually sewn in, like, different sort of, like, bullet points where, like, they're locked. And if you just spend the time talking to people, I presume like solving side quests and things like this,
right,
it starts to fill in information about them, which then makes their blood more valuable because, I don't know. You know, like that's just, I think it's just a reward for like doing things in the world and exploring more.
Sure.
But like, it sounds like how you're going to pick and choose who you kill,
because these
who
are
you
characters.
Don't kill.
Like that's the thing that yes. is part of the again part of the pitch. I'm really curious.
Are there
just random people for you to feed on, or isn't it? Is,
yes.
Okay.
So like when you're in when you're like going into like on a quest, like you'll just run into like random fucking bad dudes who want to kill you. Like there are both vampire squads that are like sort of trained to try and find leeches, as they're called. They call them vampires, but they're also more commonly referred to as leeches in the world. Well, I actually think it's like a pretty cool, like I actually wish they didn't call them vampires and just called them leeches, because I think that's like a cooler way to set up your world, that like vampires, you know, have kind of come into being in a different way. But yeah, there are just like random enemies you come across that you kill for XP. You you stun them in order to suck their blood, in order to like fill up a meter that lets you do like your different vampire skills.
Just like real vampires, like
yeah. Exactly. But it looks like that is separated from like the actual choices you're going to be making that have consequences relative to the world and, you know, relative to like whether you're trying to cause more chaos or try and get away from it. But it's there are just like a huge amount of skill trees, like skill trees within skill trees, you know, all like you pull up a system, like a menu that has all like 35 different characters that you are going to be encountering that have different blood levels and like associations. And you're going to be able to craft, like when you pull up somebody's sort of how the game is identifying them to you, how much like they're worth in terms of blood, there's also ailments that they have that you can then go craft and solve those ailments, which I presume unlocks X, Y, and Z. I guess there's a lot going on in this game to a degree that I was unaware of. I was not paying attention to this game very closely, but was sort of tangentially interested because I thought Remember Me was interesting, yeah. even if yeah. I don't know that I'd like argue super hard that it was good. It was like very interesting and ambitious and flawed in all the ways that I love like ambitious, flawed, like B-level games. And I don't know, I'm starting to get an inkling that maybe this is another one of those in a world where we don't get a lot of those games. Right. Although I will say the publisher behind it, Focus Home, is very much one of the few companies that is doing those sorts of games. Like they also published The Surge, which was a pretty decent like sci-fi robot Dark Souls type game. Yeah. And it was very B-level. Like it was not, like you played it and it was interesting, but it was not, it was trying to, it both was and wasn't trying to compete with the games in its field. I don't know. I'm interested. I went from mostly just wanting to wait for the new Life is Strange, like whenever that gets announced, to like curious to see if this vampire game pays off meaningfully. I definitely wanted to at least give people a heads up. Like, if you like Life is Strange, like this may not necessarily be one that you want on your radar because it is a fundamentally sort of different experience.
Right.
This was my 2018 game I'm looking forward to.
It
basically.
Was?
Yeah, well, because I had to change it from Psychonauts 2, because that was...
Oh, because that got right.
For sure. I'm curious.
Almost immediately after she
it was, like, during that podcast. That was very funny. I'm curious, how much is there, like, an RPG element to this? Is it just sort of in those tech trees and decisions, or does it feel like, nah, they didn't really go in that direction with this? Because for some reason, I had it in my mind that there were, like, heavy RPG sort of elements in this.
I mean, I have to imagine, like, Austin may actually be able to speak to this because he saw demos that probably, like, flesh out these mechanics more than what I've seen in the first, like, 90 minutes. But, like from my perspective in the first, like, you know, hour or so, like, yeah, there are both systems that you're aware of, which are sort of, like, they're pretty upfront about the fact that, like, hey, you're going to be making choices on who you kill and who you don't kill, and that's going to not only change the narrative, but it's going to change, like, the difficulty of the game. Like, how far that goes, right. Like, I'm curious to see if they, like, if they really push back where it's like, hey, like, this game is going to get, like, next, maybe not next to impossible, but, like, really, really fucking hard if you don't decide to, like, just suck it up and
literally
go suck some blood.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But Austin, I'm not sure what they showed
that's
you if they
very,
got a little more in depth.
Very in line with what they showed me, okay. Which was like there were some side quests and like you said, like, oh, you can go figure out how to cure this person's disease or this person needs to be, I don't know if they're escort missions, but that sort of thing. You know what I mean? There were definitely that style of thing and some dialogue options and such too, relationships that split. They very much were emphasizing the sort of like web of choices style design of like, well, if you kill this person, then they can't get revenge on this other person, which means that they'll live and therefore blah, blah, blah. because you have this whole like huge network of NPCs who are named NPCs who you can choose to kill or not kill, here's how there will be echoes into the like the butterfly effect style, like branching narrative stuff. But I don't really know if what you would get is something more like a traditional RPG or adventure game. I'm curious. I don't know. It's on my list. It's a shame it's coming out the week before
it's
E3.
A minute before E3.
Yeah. 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 So
yeah, I like I had in the back of my mind when I saw it was announcing here, it was like, I wonder if this game is bad because maybe Life is Strange will just get like announced at E3, and it's like if you just dump this game here and then Life is Strange comes out and then you can go, but here's this. Like, I don't know if that's going to happen, but like that would be like a that would be a bummer. But like in the first hour, like I don't get the sense that this is like a shitty game. Like,
no.
Like there's nothing about it suggests that. But like, would I be surprised if it was a more Remember Me-ish where it's a little like, like, we're trying to do a lot of things, and, like, maybe we don't quite pull them off, but, like, isn't it cool that we tried? Which, like, is not a bad thing. Like, there aren't enough of those games, honestly, and I'm it's cool that, like, someone like Focus Home is helping fund that kind of stuff. It's funny because, like, as I was articulating what I find interesting about it, it almost feels like I'm articulating what I wish State of Decay was more of, and like I don't know if Vampire is like going to be that, but like when we were having the discussion about like authored versus systemic and like where you find the line on that stuff, like obviously this is a very different game. I'm not saying that it's has the same goals, but like the idea of like, you know, you're causing all, you know, all sorts of decisions are happening that have all sorts of like unintended consequences, like is something I find very interesting and didn't find particularly compelling in the way it was presented in State of Decay, but maybe it's something I can find myself digging into a little bit more in the way it's sort of presented in Vampire.
Totally.
Nice.
All right, let's take a quick break and then come back because Rob, you have something I'm very curious about. I know you have to go soonish, so we'll be right back.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
All right, Rob, tell me about spaceships.
They're good. I like them.
conversation over.
You can command them and live your space admiralty fantasies in Battlestar Galactica Deadlock. It has a new expansion as of this last week called Broken Alliance, which it's a bit like XCOM War of the Chosen in that it drops a lot of new stuff into the middle of what felt like an underdeveloped game at first.
What's the expansion called again?
So it's called Broken Alliance.
Got it.
And so Battlestar Galactica Deadlock was a game that I ended up enjoying quite a bit. It was one of my favorite games from last year, even though I also felt like it fell really short of being a great Battlestar Galactica game in a lot of ways. It was kind of repetitive. Combats didn't feel like they had a lot of consequences. As far as the story went, it felt like it was just kind of nonsensically repeating some of the greatest hits from the series, even though in the lore of that universe that wouldn't make sense because this all predates the humanity extinguishing event that opens the Battlestar Galactica series.
Oh, okay.
So the entire thing felt kind of weird and off. What they've done in between is they released a smaller content update, and they also released a patch that added a new option to introduce like sticky damage to your fleets. So before, after each combat, any ships that survived were automatically brought up to full strength.
Great,
and
that seems like the opposite. I'm not a Battlestar person, even though I think I would really love Battlestar Galactica. Yeah. I know I would. It was airing while I was broken in grad school and didn't have TV and didn't like have time because of grad school, and I never got around to it. And it's something I should really get around to. But I understood, or I thought I understood, that one of the main things is that the notion of like upkeep, the notion of upkeep and repair, and like the feeling that like damage lasts and that any small mistake could cost people because it isn't easy to get new supplies. Like that was part of the core thematic tension of that series, right?
Right. Yeah. And so it was weird that like none of the damage, like if a Battlestar survived with a single like hit point, the next battle on the next turn, it was back at full strength. Mm-hmm. So it lacked a lot of that tension that makes a lot of tactics games really satisfying, which is that how you win is almost as important as whether or not you won.
Right. We talked about this a lot with Battletech this year.
Yeah. And I still think they haven't quite gone far enough. They've, like, repairing spaceships is pretty cheap in this game. Like, it doesn't feel like it is a huge new factor you have to consider. But those costs are at least there. And maybe more excitingly, sometimes you'll just forget to repair a fleet. You'll get busy and, like, you'll realize that, like, oh, yeah, like, the entire left side of every ship in this fleet has no armor. Because in the last battle I fought, like I basically cut right and exposed my left side to everyone's guns and played it that way, which really changes up your tactics. Like it's honestly, I might actually house rule that mistake into effect where I'm like only allowed to repair every two or three missions because it is so much more interesting because all your like in Battletech, all your ships have different facings. And so they have, you know, they have certain firing arcs where they're stronger, mm-hmm. and they also have armor that you know is top bottom side to side, so where you're getting hit matters a great deal, and you can sort of preserve your ship by changing facing relative to the enemy. What Broken Alliance adds is basically an entire new story campaign into the middle of the existing campaign about so in the show Battlestar Galactica, there were always these political tensions in the background. You had this idea that the humanity was not particularly united before the disaster, and that there were a lot of resentments between the different planets. This game starts to dig into that a little bit, and it's sort of trying to draw out why the creation of this sort of federal state, this alliance to fight the Cylons, why that was really over a lot of people's objections and how and what different factions among humanity were trying to do before they got subsumed into this broader like colonial fleet effort. And so it's cool. It introduces a lot of political intrigue, introduces a lot of non-Cylon enemies. And so it changes the game from being this sort of linear progression as you're just trying to almost run up your war score against the Cylons. And it turns it into more of a multi-front fight where, like, to your front, you've got the Cylons who just keep coming and keep weakening the commitment of allied planets to your cause. And then behind you, you have, like, separatists and traitors and rebels who are basically trying to sabotage the entire war effort. And you've got to fight them, too, simultaneously.
Can I ask you this, Rob?
Yeah.
As a Battlestar Galactica fan, except for the last episode, and baby tactics gamer, do you think this game might be for me? Do you think this might be a good way for me to try to wean myself off of, you know, 400 hours of Into the Breach?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly pretty accessible. It's a little bit... Did you ever play Flotilla?
Yes.
I did not. I watched Austin play it once.
Sorry, I got very excited.
Austin got really excited about Flotilla, which is good.
So this is quite a bit like Flotilla in that it's a little bit fussy in terms of when you're commanding all these different fleets and moving them through 3D space, it can be a little bit much to keep track of, but it's still very, very satisfying to sort of control the dance of your various spaceships through each turn. And because they're all going at once, you kind of have to anticipate how the enemy ships are going to move as well. You can like trigger massively destructive collisions between ships once you've really closed a point-blank range just because you didn't really think about, oh yeah, if that enemy ship completes its turn, my Battlestar is going to run headfirst into it at the end of its move. And that's kind of a cool feature in this game. So I think it's definitely very accessible. It's pretty easy to parse especially, it's one of those games where knowing Battlestar Galactica actually, like, is the best tutorial you can play for this game. Like, did you watch the show? It's like the show.
Huh.
Okay, that's rad. That might be on Baby Tactics Gamer's short list.
At this point, you have, like, 700 hours into the Breach, I think.
It's 430 or something.
Okay,
like
you're
that.
At least a toddler tactics gamer. You can't be a baby.
I'm a toddler
you
now.
You can't be a baby tactics. You have to.
Well,
you might just
only
be
my
a tactics gamer.
Tactics game.
Yeah, I know, but that's a lot of time.
You're
into
like
one.
Two.
I feel like if you have 400 hours into something that is, like, such a tactics game,
yeah,
you get to be a tactics gamer.
Oh, all right. Oh.
I don't think we're not gatekeeping.
Grade school. Maybe.
Maybe.
Or maybe a toddler. I'm in preschool.
I feel like Into the Breach is so serious of a game.
Yeah.
It's so hard that, like...
It's not easy.
It ain't easy.
Yeah, she's way more forgiving.
I have almost, like, every achievement.
See?
Sorry, go ahead, Rob. You're talking about...
No, it's fine. Like, I was just saying, like, it's a way more forgiving game than Into the Breach.
Okay. All right.
Have to see.
I have to dip my toe in a little bit there. Yeah.
Exactly. Danielle, have you been playing anything this week?
Briefly, I have been playing the Framed Collection on Switch. So Framed, for those who don't know.
Is Framed just one of those games where, like, I'm like, oh yeah, Framed. And so I'm like, wait, do I know what this is? Wait, am I?
It's that game that Hideo Kojima tweeted about.
That's
and said
exactly,
it was his favorite game from
a
couple years ago.
That was what I was going to say, like 4 years ago or something. It was like one of his favorite mobile games. He said it was so good. Basically, to make it very, very simple, it's a sort of a 2D... puzzle game, very sort of satisfying 2D puzzle game where there are a number of panels, comic-style panels. It's all very stylish. It's very stylized. It's sort of a little spy man. It's very 60s kind of looking. Little 2D spy man needs to go through a series of obstacles to get, you know, his briefcase to the end of the of the level, basically. So you're rearranging panels so that, you know, for example, there's four panels on the screen, and in one panel there's a guard. In another panel, there's a door. In another panel, there's a staircase.
Okay.
You need to figure out the order in which things need to happen so that he runs past the guard, up the staircase, into, you know, whatever the next
level
is. Two
sliding panels around?
You're just sliding panels around.
Cool.
So it's a pretty simple concept, but it's a lot of fun. It's very satisfying to kind of get it right, to sort of work out the order in your head.
How are you doing it on Switch? Is it touch-based or is it like
I was actually playing
stick?
It on a big TV
using
the analog sticks, but I'm pretty sure it's touch-based or has like a good interface for it.
I mean, if you can
it.
Use it with a controller, that's fine.
I'm playing it with a controller because that's good for me, basically, in general. But it's really fun. It's the first two games – or sorry, it's both games. I think there are only two games in the series. And just, again, like a really fun puzzle game that I played some of the first one back when it was just a mobile game, but I'm having fun sort of replaying it on Switch. It's also really pretty. It's actually like one of those mobile games that looks amazing.
Awesome.
No matter what aspect ratio it's at. So it looks beautiful on a big screen, too. That's fun.
Cool. I need to check that out because, you know, it's one of those series that I've always had. People have recommended it to me, people who aren't just Hideo Kojima.
Right.
And it's always
other
like,
people.
Wow, this has like such a cool look. And then I just like, not really what I want on my phone right now. And then I just skip it.
I'm going to play it on the plane for sure. On the way to E3. Yeah.
We definitely have some good plane time coming up for that. Yeah. So speaking of Switch games, the other game I want to play on Switch is Yoku's Pinball Adventure. Yoku's Island Express.
Yeah.
A game that I wrote about on Friday, a game I didn't know existed until I just like saw an idle tweet going by my timeline that just said, Metroid Pinball. And I was like, oh, that sounds all right. But there are so many, like the eShop, the Nintendo Switch, used to be this place where a couple games went up each week and most of them were like really high quality. And now the gold rush has turned into a silver rush, has turned into a bronze rush. There are so many games going.
Right,
we're not
right.
at Steam levels, but like give it a year and then, like, you know, there'll be, you know, 30 games going up each week. It's just, you know, that's nothing against like, you know, the indie developers trying to make it work on Switch, like go get your money. But it often just means like a lot of it just like kind of blurs together. It's hard to tell like what's actually worth paying attention to. But that one like really caught my eye because I'm someone that like likes pinball but doesn't enjoy playing it past a couple of rounds because like high score just doesn't do anything for me.
I like
me.
Playing
like,
a board until I see all of its gimmicks and then I'm like, all right, I'm done.
Yeah.
Cool. I see what all the gimmicks are. Bye. And that's it.
Right. Yeah, and it's just like trying to beat my own score, trying to beat a, you know, a high score that I'm not going to get anywhere close to. Like, it's just not enough of an incentive. But like, I've really enjoyed over the years like different games that take pinball mechanics and drop them into a different structure. So even ones like Sonic Spinball that are like still largely a pinball game, like there's just a little more to it. Like Kirby's Pinball Land. Is that right?
Sounds like a
thing. I think that's right. I might have gotten the title wrong there. But, like, that was, like, a really terrific, like, merging of, like, Kirby mechanics and pinball and, like, to a larger structure. So, like, just, like, if you do that and, like, there are so few of those that I get really interested. And so I was hopeful that this one was actually good and not just, like, following a line of games that I just sort of, like, find myself attracted to on mere concept alone. But, yeah. Yoku's Island Express is like a really charming, really interesting, really beautiful, really fun mashup of pinball and yeah, like Metroid, like exploring where you're trying. There's this giant ass map, and some parts of it you can access, and other parts you're not gonna be able to access until you have like the right tool. And I've played so many of those types of games in the regular like action platformer format that just doesn't really do it enough for me these days. I mean, like, certain ones are good enough. Like, I've heard Hollow Knight is really terrific, and I'm excited to play that whenever that finally comes out on Switch. I really enjoyed, like, Ori and the Blind Forest. So, like, there are times when I enjoy that type of game, but, like, it's just rare these days because there are just so many of them where we went from a world where, like, a new Metroid was a big deal because we need another one of those. And these days there are a lot of Metroid-alikes. This one is it's a really terrific map. Like, the mashup works really well, and I highly recommend it both on Switch. It's on PS4 and Xbox and PC.
Your story made it sound like there was some thirstiness in that game.
Okay. So
I didn't understand.
Like, yes,
I had to send you a note that was like, "What are you talking about?"
So this game is I'm not sure what levels it's operating yet. I'm hypothesizing, I'm inferring a little bit, but the first major quest that you have in the game is to like go find a mushroom for this eel that's blocking your path. And then you go up, you find this mushroom, you're like, cool. But if you just go slightly to the right, there's a secret passage where there's a poison mushroom, and then you go down and the game presents you with a choice. Give him the mushroom, which will make him happy and he'll move out of the way, or give him the poison mushroom and put him in a coma. And the game doesn't present why would you do one or the other? Like, this isn't Vampire where it's like up front, it's like, hey, your choices are going to have an impact on where this story goes. It's just like, hey, do you want to fuck up this eel's day real bad?
This sounds like Phantom Thread right here. In the stream,
I did it. I gave him that poison mushroom. And then in my canon playthrough that I'm doing on my Switch, I gave him the regular mushroom, and he takes the mushroom and he eats it, and he just goes away. Ooh. Like, he's like, cool, thanks for your help. And then some other stuff that's happening in this game,
shit
like
right here,
I'm wondering, right? And I like it if games are going to be, even if it doesn't deliver on it, like, that's a really fun, like, interesting wrinkle to put into the game, right? Like, it doesn't have to have some massive payoff, but like just putting in a choice, just to arbitrarily have a choice where you could just kind of be a like a fucking asshole for like no good reason, like, is, I don't know, that's pretty good. Right. And then later, I got, you encounter like one of the first like sort of mechanics that gets added to your repertoire is the ability to sort of like vacuum up these toads that are kind of like scattered throughout the world. And like, for whatever reason, like, the reason those toads explode is because they're horny. Like, the game is like outright explicit, like, yo, these are horny toads. It's mating season. You throw these toads against a wall, they're going to fucking blow up, and then you can make your way. So, like, you are just sucking up horny toads, throwing them against a wall, and then they explode because they're horny.
Okay.
Pinball.
not your granddad's pinball machines anymore. Now they're horny. That's actually not true. My granddad's pinball machines were extremely horny.
Were
also,
horny.
That's
I was gonna say there were some street. Yeah, there were a lot of like pinup girl pinball machines. Yep. Playboy had a machine. So if anything, like, we become less horny. We're just going
back to the roots of pinball horniness.
horny
toads.
It's also like it's really well written. It's very charming. Like, in none of like the horny humor works really well. Like, it's very funny. Like, I was like laughing at the game. Like, it's just like very lovingly crafted from top to bottom, and it's truly just like a joy to play. Like, it's one of those where like I have other games I should be playing, and then I'm picking up my Switch, and I've been kind of plucking my way through it, but I also know that I have, you know, a 4.5 hour flight coming up to go to E3, and I'm like, this is a game I want to save for that. So I've actually been putting it down, not playing it, because I want to save it for, like, the ideal scenario, which is, like, on a flight and just sort of just indulging in it. So I highly recommend it, and yes, it is on Switch, so we don't have to port beg for this one. It's already nice. There.
Awesome. We should dip quickly into the question bucket. Rob has left us for the day.
The building. He couldn't take the horny toad.
That's what he said. He said, no more horny toads on my watch. I got to go. And he left. This one, if you have a question, you can send it in to gaming@vice.com. This question comes in from Harrison, who says, hey, Waypoint team, I'm curious what you all think video games will look like in 10 to 20 years. Assuming graphical improvements reach a point of diminishing returns, what new directions do you think the industry will move in? Looking for answers both to what you hope to see, procedural generation that can make cohesive and engaging stories, as well as what the cynic in you dreads will happen. Ads and product placement in big budget games? Thanks, Harrison from New Jersey.
I feel like the cynical one is very easy, and it's like every major corporation has some sort of game stake. Like, there's the AT&T game that's basically Fortnite, but with more loot boxes or whatever. You know, like, really cynical sort of, yeah, of course, every corporation will get into the game in some level.
In some way.
Yeah. Or have some sort of stake in the business in some way. And that will...
In the way that, like, Disney has bought up so many different kind of entertainment corporations, yeah. We end up getting Activision, Blizzard, Disney, or like
Actiblizney.
Actiblizney, uh-huh. Or we get like Comcast buys EA,
yeah.
And then that's
and
great.
And you'll get Comcast's
Xfinity A.
Yeah, Xfinity A.
Well, I think like part of that potential path, like I would say actually some of my cynicism has been dampened by the fact that the Switch has been as big a success as it has been, because I feel like Nintendo, like, is such a nice counter to, like, the focus on, like, the kinds of games that are built by companies like Microsoft and Sony, as much as I like a lot of those games. And, like, Nintendo as its own independent entity is such a nice tonic, even when they're kind of flailing about. They're always, like, interesting. So, like, imagine a world where the Switch bombed. And then they had to, like, I don't know, make a full pivot to mobile, or, like, had to start publishing Mario games on, like, the Xbox and PlayStation. It's just, like, ugh. Like, I don't want to be in that world. I like the world where Nintendo operates independently. And so, actually, like, my most cynical, like, I was thinking a year ago when the Switch was launched, like, that was my fear. It was like, oh, fuck, like, they're going to fuck this up a second time. And then, like, Nintendo's going to go the way of Sega. And, like, Sega's actually kind of pretty interesting these days, but it took a long time for them to get there. And yeah, so I don't know. My most, like, loot boxes are seem to be going away. Yeah. So it's like that would have been like the previous one where I'd be like, ah, fuck, that's what's going to be in every game. But actually, like, now you have, like, you know, DICE saying outright, like, hell yeah, no loot boxes in our game after our last game had lots of loot boxes. So isn't that cool? So I actually don't think loot boxes are going to be, I think they'll remain like a thing. Like, you know, Overwatch and some other games are still going to have them, but I think it's on people's radar so much that, like, that's been taken off my, like,
perch. Cash grab. There's got to be some sort of.
I think they'll figure out new ways.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
I'll give my hopeful first, which is sustainability, which is two things converging. One, a push for unionization and collective bargaining among AAA and across game devs in general. We've talked about this at length last week. But at the same time, finding alliance with that or finding affinity with that, a move towards games as service that lowers the risk in the AAA space. So that things look more like the recent Ubisoft model around games like Rainbow Six Siege, The Division, Wildlands, games that a model that doesn't require the turnaround time to be as quick. Mm-hmm. The Division came out. I was still a Giant Bomb when The Division came out. Right. So it was 2015, right? It's 2018. We know The Division 2 will be announced this year. It'll probably come out this year. It's a gut me guessing thing that we'll see, if not this year, early next year.
It's probably next year because they've already kind of signaled that Assassin's Creed is not going to be this fall.
Wait, then what's their big fall release?
Maybe. Well, it could be the Division.
Too. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yeah, that's – yeah.
Or Watch Dogs, which also seems due.
That seems due, but I don't – I haven't heard any rumblings. We'll see.
That was 2016, wasn't it?
That was 2016, yeah. Watch Dogs 2. Anyway.
Yeah.
But like, this is the point that we're talking about right now, is that there's a longer dev cycle on those, and they're focused on maintaining game support. I want to, 10 years from now, be in a world where we can imagine Anthem 2 and not Anthem 3 or 4. Destiny, you know, the 10-year promise of Destiny was not going to happen under the old model, which required that studio and the studios that made some of their side content to be hustling at such a rate that they were constantly – that Bungie was constantly just trying to right the ship and not necessarily like build a sustainable path going forward. And so a move towards games as platforms, games as services in that big space, and then the proliferation of smaller games by independent studios and by small studios and by small publishers to rebuild up what we thought of as a long time as that B game space, mm-hmm. Where tools are accessible and affordable enough to build something that today would seem ambitious in the 10 to 20 hour space or the 20 to 30 hour space. That's where I'd like to see games be in 10 to 20 years. That's my hopeful, optimistic. I can imagine that sense.
Yeah.
My cynical sense is a crash. Is 10 to 20 years is a lot of time. Games are super, super expensive, and a move to, and maybe this isn't so cynical in some ways, but like if I am, I think it builds off of maybe your cynical thing, Danielle, which is like AT&T gets into the business and then actually looks at what games cost to make and what the risk is like. And they're like, why are we making video games? We could be making anything with this money. Like phones have a much better turnaround and are much less risky. Or, you know, there's so many products you can make with that money that are not – that when they bomb, don't bomb in the same way. And so I could imagine a world in which we see an incredible decrease in what we think of as AAA game production. Not a complete crash at this point, not a 1980s style, right. the home console crash. It's fucked. But something where it becomes too unsustainable and too risky for independent game developers to keep throwing their life savings into projects, into passion projects, and a world in which big companies don't want to take any risks at all. And so we get more homogenous games and less and less production in general. Yeah. We'll see. I mean,
everything
some ways
– consolidates in certain ways.
Right. In some ways, my hope and my fear are not that dissimilar, right? Yeah. Like there's a version of the, sustainable game production means less risk-taking. And means less – like games as platforms mean less new IP and less new ideas in those spaces, relying only on workers who have lots of experience and who are – and no room for new people to move into those spaces. So there's ways in which my hope could be tinted poorly, but those are – that's kind of where I'm at. I don't know.
My truest hope – so I already said my cynical one.
Yeah.
My truest hope obviously wanting people to have sustainable lives just in life in America, having things like universal health care and having sustainable systems where people can make the things they want to make and can be have a life and live and be okay, and fostering that, having tools that actually make something like, so if you go on itch.io, you can find a million tiny games, and I love that we can do that. A lot of times sort of the tools are at such a level where it's very easy to make, not easy, I don't want to say easy because I know it's not easy, but you can imagine most types of people being able to make something that looks like an NES game and even like a really great NES game.
Right.
My hope is that tools become better and better and better, and maybe this is what Dreams wants to do. I know that's kind of the dream.
Right, right. That's the
something
dream.
Like
that's
an N64
dream.
Game, or eventually, I want immersive Sims.
Right.
I want it to be affordable and an okay thing to do, where a very, very small team or even one person could make like a brilliant and amazing immersive Sim. Basically, that genres that are great and I love don't die and have like really interesting work being done in them. Whether or not it's like intensely commercial work, it probably won't be, but I would like that to live. So, hey, in 10 years, if there are, people making something like Prey and they're able to do that in smaller teams, that would be ideal.
Awesome. Here's a quick one that came in from Dan.
Hey, my dream is that Spelunky 2
is good.
That's
a good dream,
Patrick. That's
a good dream.
Hey, dream number two. Hey, Miyazaki, go make that Mech Souls game. Get the fuck out.
Do that before the crash that I predicted. That's the last video game.
Oh.
Mech Souls.
That'd be last all right. Game yeah. of all time.
It would be that. That would be on point. I'm sure that game would end with some sort of terrible choice about whether or not to keep.
There's no more technology.
There's no more. You have to decide either there's no more technology and we go to the dark, or there's technology takes over everything.
And nobody has a soul
anymore. No one has a soul. Yeah, exactly.
The darkest soul.
The darkest soul.
That's what we call it.
Uh-huh. This comes from Dan from St. Louis, who says, "Hello, Waypoint. Last year, we had Mario Odyssey. This year, we have Assassin's Creed Odyssey. What's the next game on your wish list for the Odyssey treatment?"
Prey Odyssey.
Ooh.
What would you say?
Prey Odyssey.
What's that game look like?
It's a series of Prey-like games.
Oh, it's like an anthology.
It's an anthology because okay. there's so many of them and they're all amazing.
Mm.
Yeah, that's what my dream was.
Gotcha. All
right.
Huh.
Abe's Odyssey.
Well, they are making another one of those, yeah. So. I'm trying to think of like, trying to think of a franchise where it's just
just slap it on there.
Red Faction Odyssey.
Oh, we should explain why we name drop Space Asshole at the top of this.
You know.
Yeah, probably. Oh, yeah. What? You mean we should explain an obscure internet podcast yeah. joke that is like largely relegated to like the people in the media and like listeners
hey,
of
a
relatively successful podcast? Yeah.
Yeah. So Red Faction Guerrilla is getting a remaster and they licensed.
Remaster?
Oh,
my fucking God. I hate it so much. Oh, yeah, Red...
There's got to be a Red Dead
like
joke
a remarstened, that's what they could have called.
Mars.
That's what...
It's also dead and it's red.
Yeah, I gotcha. they are remaking or remastering, not remaking, remastering Red Faction Guerrilla.
Yeah.
A game for which Chris Remo...
Underrated.
Yeah.
Underrated game, by the way. Good game.
I stand on the other side of history with this.
All right.
I think that game didn't give you enough restrictions. That's what I think. My favorite parts of that game were the timed mini games where it was like destroy
sure.
this building
yeah.
with seven like grenades or with like just your hammer and this one shot of the
canvas
of the disintegration.
Blank.
Yeah, yeah, the canvas all was right. too blank. Exactly. So but in the main game, I've said this before. In the main game, I ended up getting like a three weapon like setup or whatever that was like too strong, and I solved every problem with the same exact setup, and
it
was just like what I should have done was just
marred
it with an R. That way it's like Mars. I got you. What I should have done is just forced myself to use other weapons, but like the arc gun took care of vehicles really quickly, and then like the disintegration gun by the mid game was just so strong that I was like, okay, between vehicles I can take over and this gun, there's no challenge. And it's not like I want a challenge. What I wanted was to be forced to be creative because their tool set was so fucking good. Anyway, that game had a song written about it by Chris Remo of Idle Thumbs, and you might know from Campo Santo now, who released Firewatch a couple of years ago. And he wrote a song called Space Asshole and performed it on Idle Thumbs. And then I guess THQ Nordic licensed it for the release for the announcement trailer of the remaster.
Yeah.
And it's very funny that I thought they would be re-recording it or something at most, you know what I mean? I thought they would do like
a podcast version.
That's just the version that Chris recorded 8 years ago or whatever.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's a fun. I wish that video was a little bit better. I wish they had edited the trailer more to his lyrics, but that's okay.
Give it to Derek Liu.
Yeah,
give it to
really
right. Good
give it to you.
Trailers.
You could have done.
I could have done that. You know.
You know, we're not in the press, or we're in the press, so we can't just do shit for. We couldn't do it, but you know. We could have found an exception.
Maybe they were in a big rush.
Yes, yes.
You know,
anyway,
we had an hour to do it. I understand.
So your thing, is that what you're committing to? A Red Faction Odyssey, Patrick? That's
hell
good.
Yeah. See what you want to see in the world.
100%.
Give me another Red Faction game. I'm like, give me Red Faction.
Right, I got a really good answer here. It's called Armored Core Odyssey.
Okay.
And, you know, the past Armored Core games have been kind of mission-based, but in this one it's like an Odyssey. So it's like an open world, kind of an adventure, like an action adventure, maybe some RPG elements in there. And it's you and your mech, and you're going on an Odyssey together. You're going on an adventure. You're exploring this like kind of it's almost like there's a central hub that has like all these other areas around it, and you can explore it. And some of the parts you can go with your mech, and then sometimes you have to get out of your mech and explore it. And it's like really deliberate combat. And like it's very much about like what weapons you equip changes how you and your mech attack. And I think maybe there's some sort of like, you know, there's like a booster system on the mech that you have to gate, like you have like a boost gauge or like a stamina gauge, I guess you could call it. So something like that would be like kind of like, I guess it'd be like a little bit like a, what if there was like a giant robot mech Dark Souls, like something like that, Armored Core Odyssey. That's what I would make.
Tell Miyazaki.
I'm gonna see him at E3 and be like, "Yo,
hey, where is it?"
I'm not actually. I don't think I'm actually gonna see.
Here's my design doc.
Right.
You're welcome.
Here it is. You know? Wink. You'll see it already says by Miyazaki and Austin, his best friend. So.
I love that.
That's it. That's it.
M&A.
Right. That's what they call
that's
us.
Beautiful.
That's what from Stinton doesn't work. I'm Austin Walker. I think that's going to do it for us this week. We are done with questions. If you have questions again, you can send them to questions at I almost said questions at idlethumbs.com.
Really
I almost did.
Oh
my I've never even been on Idle Weekend and I've been on Three Moves Ahead.
Yeah.
I'm going to be on Three Moves Ahead again soon to talk
that's
about
exciting.
A game, which is exciting. You want to do waypoints before we go?
Yeah.
What are your waypoints?
Go ahead, Patrick.
I watched a really good movie on Friday that I had very little. I don't know much about it. It's a movie called Date Night with Rachel McAdams and Jason Bateman, and more importantly, Jesse Plemons, the most people know from Breaking Bad, and but more people should know him from Friday Night Lights.
Yeah,
is a really really good character actor. Who just is his
demeanor
is
you said honest. Date Night, which is that Steve Carell
game night, right?
Oh, Game Night.
Okay,
game
I thought you just said Date Night, and I was very confused.
Okay.
Okay.
Game Night.
I think you're right. It's Game Night.
Okay. Jesse Plum is just a very unassuming, and so he like finds a way to kind of like slip into roles and surprise you because he just. I don't know, for like, he just doesn't seem like the kind of person that has like a certain range and that he does. And like his appearance like allows him to surprise you in those ways. And like he is the far and away the highlight of this movie. Like complicated feelings about the fucking Jason Bateman, given the way that he handled some recent events with Arrested Development. So like bad. But the other parts of this movie are so strong. Like Rachel McAdams, who's like generally an actress that I like, but she is so funny in this movie in a way that like is like she genuinely shocks you and like I knew she could be like funny but like I didn't know like she could be like this funny. Like there's very specifically like there's a scene involving vomit but not actual vomit that like you'll know when you see it. It's a very funny, charming movie that I guess I should say the setup is like that this group of friends gets together every week for a game night, and they play like charades and board games and stuff like that. It's kind of an excuse to like just together and drink and shoot the shit. And then Jason Bateman's brother, who is played by Coach Taylor from Friday Night Lights, so there is a wonderful crossover there. I refuse to call him by his actual actor name. He is Coach Taylor for me forever and ever, and they should just put him in the credits as that going forward just to make things easier. Great part of this movie is that in Friday Lights and a lot of the other roles that he plays are like just like very charming, nice, like you want this man to be your dad sort of characters. And in this, he is just a brash asshole, like so full of himself. And it's just part of it's because of playing against expectations, and part of it's that he's very good at playing that kind of character in a surprising sort of way. And he kind of shows up and says, "Hey, actually, we're going to do game night at my place." He's also rich, by the way. So they go to like his rich house and they do this game night, which is like supposed to be a thing where like actual actors are going to show up, and like you know you're not going to know what's real and not real. And then it mashes up with like an actual crime, and they don't know, like they as characters don't know that they're actually, you know, participating in something like really bad, that they're playing as though they're part of this like fun game night game. And yeah, it goes to some really weird places. And I highly recommend it.
Awesome.
I want to see that.
Yeah. Danielle, what is your waypoint for the week?
Last night I watched The Shape of Water and I, Tonya back to back again. Mm-hmm. I'll talk about I, Tonya because I feel like people know that The Shape of Water is pretty awesome.
Yeah,
it got Best Picture. You know?
It did.
Not
do that.
Like gunning for the little guy at this point with that, but I, Tonya is a wonderful, wonderful movie, and I will stand by that, and I will fight you.
None of us are trying to fight you.
I will fight you. Not you, but I mean
but
the royal
conceptually.
You.
Conceptually,
yeah.
I think it's. It's good. I think my only problem with that movie was that it felt like
she'll fight you.
I will fight you.
I just it seemed slightly a little too defensive of Tanya Harding as like, but it was a very good movie, and her performance is
yeah.
Terrific
in
that movie,
I mean, so. Like yes, it takes a point of view for sure, but I think it probably should have like considering
sure,
like
yeah.
it's a better movie for having a very strong point of view on Tanya Harding, absolutely, mm-hmm. and it's a movie that is really difficult to watch at times because it's like it's basically played up as a comedy in a lot of ways. Mm. The music choices, the shot selection, everything about it feels very comedic. But it's a really tragic story. It's a really horrifying story about abuse, basically, and how badly she was abused and sort of like what went along with that and how much of a damaged person she was and still sort of in the limelight and so on and so forth. Margot Robbie, absolutely, God, is incredible in that role. She's so dynamic and she's so hurt, but trying to make her way through it and trying to smile her way through it. There's literally a scene at the end where she is sobbing and trying to put on her happy doll makeup yeah. for her, you know, her last skate in the movie. That is so heartbreaking. Allison Janney is also incredible in that movie as her really toxic, abusive
mother.
Mom,
right?
Yeah, as her mom. So really highly recommended with a giant, like, content warning on there for like abuse just happens all the time. There'll be like a happy funny scene with happy fun music and oh my god something really dark
right.
happens. So like just know it's kind of a whiplash. It's definitely the point of the movie. It's definitely like in you know
yeah.
it fits the movie, but it's one of those things where like I tell people going in just in case yeah. just know that that's gonna happen.
Gotcha.
So yeah,
awesome. My waypoint for the week is a musician. Her name is 070 Shake. She has an EP called Glitter. The project she's part of, 070, is the 070 project, has a mixtape together. She is one of the highlights of a truly mixed to bad Kanye West album that just dropped. Yay. The best song for my money on that album is a song called Ghost Town, and she does this like incredible outro to it, and it is one of those things where it's like when you hear someone like that on a huge release from an artist with an incredible platform, like do your best to find their actual work. That's been a thing that has come out of that entire group for the last 10 years has been like, you know, one of the best things Kanye West has probably done is put me on some other people, right? There are some people who maybe don't stand up to the test of time that way, but that is one of the things as a musician when you do have a platform that you can do is just share it. And 070 Shake stuff, you know, she's like a 20-year-old rapper from North Bergen, New Jersey, and is really fantastic as a vocalist, as a rapper, and her whole crew is sick. So like 070 Shake.
As in like 070?
Like 070. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Really good. And also, I guess I'm sure some people have been asking me what I think about that album. I do my best not to plug my side projects here, but I do a Kanye West bracket podcast called One Song Only with some friends of mine. And if you want to hear us talk about that album, and also if you want to hear us talk very honestly about where we're at with Kanye, you should go listen to that podcast. We should have an ep up this week on the new album, plus the Pusha T album, plus some of the beef between
the
of course we got okay. into the Drake stuff, of
you
course,
need to listen to
of course,
for sure.
You know, you are hiding a child, so it's. A lot. So go listen to that. If you're very curious, if you're so curious as to what I think about that, that is where you'll find me talking about that. All right. That is going to do it for us. As always, shout outs to Bowen for letting us use it. Oh, sorry. Rob didn't get to do a waypoint. I'm going to just channel Rob. He says boats.
Yep.
Boat. You should check out boats.
Stare forlornly at the sea.
Yeah. Oh, actually, I can give one for Rob, which is if you didn't see our Sea of Thieves stream last week. So last week, Danica, Rob, and I in the middle of the week were like, oh, we're going to try the new DLC for – not DLC, the new patch, the new update for Sea of Thieves. They added like a boss. They added like a boss shark, like a megalodon. And so we did the first half of it. You don't really need to watch that first stream. It's okay. Watch the second stream because it was the three of us. Natalie joined us. And then the way that fight works is you have to do all this kind of like – puzzle solving to kind of there's kind of riddles and you have to go find these journal pieces and then you end up getting some new stuff like a horn that lets you talk to anybody in the area like long distance and like some a drum, a new instrument. and you have to gather five people, which is more than you can have on a single ship, because the single ship, the single crew is four people max. So you have to find another real player, at least one, to come play this one song in the middle of the ocean at a specific spot, and it will summon this giant shark to fight. And we had honestly the most magical experience I think I've had playing a game in a long time, in which we ended up recruiting two other ships, one of which was filled with like little kids who are very sweet, who are very sweet and take charge and were very inquisitive. And then there was another group of people who were probably about our age, maybe a little younger, but who were totally chill too. And we ended up having this incredible fight against the shark. It was so exciting and so funny and heartwarming, because these kids who we were playing with were like pure and good and did not milkshake duck ever. So it was very I hope they never do.
He has a dog named Panther.
It's a very charming. It's a great stream. So go look at that. That's up on our YouTube now. Waypoint Vice on YouTube, youtube.com/waypointvice. So go check that out. That is actually my stand-in for Rob's Waypoint boats, but also specifically
that boat.
The boat that we. I guess our boat never actually sunk at the end. We thought it was going to get shot down, but some randos ran onto our boat, stole our cannons, and shot down another ship instead. It was a whole thing. Anyway, go check that out. Again, youtube.com/waypointvice. All right. Thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. Where can people find you on the internet, Danielle?
At Danielle R.I.
What about you, Patrick?
At Patrick Lubbock.
Find me at Austin_Walker, and find everything that Waypoint does at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice, and waypoint.vice.com. We're going to be back with some streams all week. I'm thinking maybe for Friday we do like an E3 Q&A podcast.
Get ready if you have E3 questions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we'll fill our question bucket with E3 questions for Friday. Send those in, again, gaming@vice.com. All right, everybody. That's going to do it for us. Danielle, what do we say to them?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.